This is an ABC podcast.
This is the WA Country Hour on ABC Radio WA.
Well, hello and welcome to another day here on the Country Hour right across Western Australia. Thanks for tuning in this Wednesday arvo. I'm Kate Forrester. Coming up on the program today, you're going to hear what Prime Minister Anthony Albanese had to say in response to some questions he was asked yesterday about the government-backed program buying fishing boats for illegal fishers in Australia's north. So you may have heard that the PM was in WA yesterday in the southwest, and when he was asked, he really didn't give away much information at all to how much this program is costing Aussie taxpayers. So I'll bring you a little bit about what he had to say later on in the program. And then after the weather and the rainfall figures with Richard Hudson at 12:30, I am going to take you to the Midwest, where there's been quite a bit of fire and storm activity over the past few days for a local shire. So stay tuned to find out where that is and how many hectares were burnt. 12:06 here on the Country Hour, right across Western Australia this Wednesday afternoon. Well, the Chief Executive Officer of the CSIRO says their latest job cuts are difficult but necessary changes to safeguard the National Science Agency. The organisation announced yesterday it will cut up to 350 jobs as it battles with long-term financial challenges. CEO Dr. Doug Hilton says going forward, they want to prioritise research areas that actually matter to Australians.
Over the last 18 months, for probably the first time in decades, we've looked at the whole research portfolio of CSIRO. And we've asked about the areas that we think the organisation could be uniquely placed to make the best possible contribution to Australia's future. So going through that process, we've identified areas that we will focus on and areas that, as you say, we'll deprioritise. Mm.
If you had more money from the federal government, would you be making these cuts?
The organisation over 100 years has always focused its research in different ways. The science we're doing now is very different to the science we were doing 50 years ago. So there's always going to be a need to refine the skills of our workforce to be able to change direction. I think that's something the Australian community would expect us to do. Science is never static. It always evolves. It always changes. It builds on discoveries that have been previously made. So we always need to be nimble.
You've sort of skillfully talked around my question there. I think people watching would simply ask, if you had more money, would you do more research? I mean, would you be making these cuts if you had more federal funding?
We would always make changes, but of course, if we were given more appropriation, there's a lot more science to do. And I think the government's aware of that. It's announced some months ago the strategic examination of research and development in Australia. So I think it understands that trajectory of science in Australia is really important for our future. Mm-hmm. And a great example of that is, you know, we've talked a lot about how we turn our critical minerals wealth into critical materials for manufacturing. That happens because of great science, and we need to do the science to make those processes clean and green.
What is going to be the priority now for the CSIRO, and how should we judge the success of a restructure like this, which is going to cause a lot of internal angst? Are we looking at breakthroughs, certain KPIs that you're going to be setting for these priority areas?
Yeah, so we're looking across all of our research. We have some fantastic programs that have delivered great benefits over 20, 30 years, things like the work in agriculture to make our industry more sustainable and more productive. And I think the Australian community can expect us to continue to do that. We'll also focus on, you know, one of the great problems confronting the nation, which is the energy transition. Mm-hmm. CSIRO does a lot of work to help build a system that is reliable, that is affordable, and that is sustainable for the nation.
Dr. Doug Hilton, CEO of the CSIRO, speaking to James Glenday on ABC News Breakfast earlier today. And as you heard Dr. Hilton pinpointing there, the organisation going forward is going to continue its research on energy, critical minerals and climate change adaptation, as well as looking at agriculture, technology on the farm and biosecurity. So what do you make of this today? Do share your thoughts, 0448 922 104. At the end, you heard the CEO saying they're going to be really focusing on that energy transition. So how do you feel about that? Please let me know. 0448 922 604. Well, the recent job cuts at CSIRO have raised concerns about where the future of research in Australia is going to go. Dr. Bruce Weber is a former employee who spent 16 years with the organisation looking into biosecurity and environmental science up until a few years ago. Bruce, how did you feel when you heard about these latest job cuts at your former workplace?
It's always sad to hear the news about job cuts at any organisation. It creates a level of uncertainty on direction and future opportunities. So that's sad. But it's also a time to reflect on priorities, and hopefully they will be able to work towards better outcomes, or at least as good outcomes as possible from this changing situation.
You just heard then from CEO Dr. Doug Hilton of CSIRO, who basically was saying they want to prioritise research areas, and this is because of long-term financial challenges. Do you actually think, Bruce, that reflects what is actually going on at CSIRO?
Well, the data is really clear on this. It's been released by a number of different sources in the last few weeks that I've seen, and there has been a decline in CSIRO funding over the last few decades. That does create challenges for an organisation that is trying to maintain or increase its research impact. There's no doubt about that.
But from your experience inside the organisation, what are these cuts actually going to mean for science that is being done, and how significant is this impact going to be going forward?
That's going to really depend on where the cuts take place. If it's only cuts to staff, is there's flow-on effects to also the infrastructure that the staff need to undertake their research. That will flow out over the next few months, as I understand. CSIRO fills an incredibly important role in our national research infrastructure. It's one of the few organisations in Australia that is able to undertake large research at considerable scale, tackling really complex issues, particularly for public good focused research, that research that is sort of driven by the tragedy of the commons, where there's not huge commercial imperative to pursue that research, but it is absolutely essential research for the future of our nation. And that's where we need to have CSIRO doing heavy lifting in an ongoing way into the future. So I do hope that that type of research, the public good research in environment space, tackling climate change, tackling biosecurities, remains a priority for the organisation going forward, and that the organisation has the resources to deploy against those really complex, large, ongoing, long-term challenges in that space.
Well, I was just going to ask that. Do you think going forward they're actually going to have the appropriate resources to tackle those areas?
Again, the numbers will have to dictate this going forward, and I don't have access to the numbers, and I don't think any of us do as yet. But if we see that the overall research funding is declining, that's the appropriation money that the CEO was talking about, then CSIRO does have to find other ways to fund that research. Maybe many people are not aware that the vast majority of CSIRO's funding comes from external sources now, and there will need to be stronger efforts to find other sources of funding to complement what is being provided by the government. The great advantage of having funding from a government source is it allows that freedom to pursue, as I said, those issues that are not potentially commercially important, but fundamentally essential for the future of our nation. We face enormous challenges going forward as a nation dealing with issues like global environmental change. How do we save our biodiversity? How do we ensure we achieve conservation outcomes and great agricultural resilience in a changing climate? These are all national challenges that CSIRO is so well placed to address in collaboration with other organisations. So I would like to see that continue.
This is the WA Country Hour. It is 14 past 12. At the moment, I'm just chatting to Dr. Bruce Weber, who used to work at the CSIRO as a researcher, but left a few years ago, so is no longer employed by them. And I am interested to know, Bruce, why did you leave? Was it because you were made redundant back then too?
A wonderful job opportunity at another organisation. It's quite simple for me. I'm chasing impact. I want to achieve impact at scale in the conservation space. And an organisation, Bush Heritage Australia, presented me with that wonderful opportunity. It's not to say that I don't keep working with CSIRO. We do have some great collaborations in an ongoing way with CSIRO scientists, and it's an absolute pleasure to work with them.
But, you know, leaving CSIRO to another opportunity, obviously it's great for you, but could you see the writing on the wall back then?
Oh, look, CSIRO is a place, as you know, as the CEO pointed out, that goes through ongoing change and ongoing revision of its priorities going forward. I was in a part of the organisation that had a very solid funding stream through both internal and external sources. We were very well supported in that space, so I didn't feel particularly under threat from a lack of funds where I was working.
I want you to tell me a little bit about what you do now, Bruce, because I understand you're heavily involved in the shot hole borer response. How is that work progressing, do you think?
So that's work that I'm doing through the University of Western Australia. I've had an adjunct appointment with the University of Western Australia for a very long time now. We are achieving some really good insight. Sadly, it's probably come at a point in the attempted eradication process, maybe a little bit too late. But I think still we're hoping to get some really transformative results out towards the end of this year, and hopefully that should allow a step change in how we treat trees infested with the shot hole borer and achieve some really big outcomes in terms of biosecurity and keeping that beast contained to Western Australia and at least the Greater Perth, if at all possible.
But surely yesterday, the confidence of scientists around Australia would have been tarred a bit, because if you're putting all of this hard work into something like the shot hole borer, and then you hear about job cuts at our nation's leading science organisation, what confidence does that give people like yourself in where the future of Australian research is going?
Superficially, it is unsettling. We do need to ensure that we are investing considerable amounts going forward across all science research sectors in Australia. It's well proven, the data shows, that if you invest in good science research in innovation space, you get returns in abundance, well above the amount you invest. From a conservation sector space, there's a really strong push at the moment to invest 1% of GDP into the environment. It's been proven by crunching the numbers that this is what we need to achieve the ambitious conservation outcomes that we've all agreed to. 30% of Australia protected by 2030, for example.
If you're listening and you're a member of the agriculture industry or somewhere in rural Western Australia, how worried do you think you should be that we have had these losses at CSIRO? What's it going to mean for agriculture?
That's a really good question. That's beyond the range of my remit within CSIRO, but I do know a lot of exceptional research scientists working for CSIRO in the agricultural space in Western Australia. I know they have achieved many significant things over the past few decades, and I would like to ensure that they are allowed to and in a position to keep that research going into the future. Again, until the priorities emerge from this current set of reprioritising, it's really hard to predict where that's going to go. It's not only CSIRO who are doing great research in the ag sector in Western Australia. They're collaborating with a whole range of other institutions. So, you know, if there was an outcome that resulted in CSIRO scientists not continuing at their current institution, I would like to think that we could see them continuing in another way in Western Australia. The tragedy would be to lose them to research organisations overseas, but let's hope that's not the case.
Dr. Bruce Weber, thank you for your time today.
My pleasure.
Dr. Bruce Weber is a former employee of the CSIRO. He now works at UWA on the Shotalbora response and also with Bush Heritage Australia. And you heard I was just chatting to Bruce about the work that he does on the Shotalbora response. And in other news about this area, the State Agriculture Minister, Jackie Jarvis, has just announced this morning that the state government is going to be providing another $1 million to help support local governments impacted by the invasive pest, the Shotalbora. Now, the funding comes from the first round of a local government grant program. Minister Jarvis says the money will help 20 local governments deliver more than 2,700 new trees across Perth metropolitan communities. This is part of the state government's $7.2 million response to replace trees lost to the tiny beetle. And if you'd like to find out more about what is being done about the Shotalbora response in WA, just search DPIRD and Bora. That's DPIRD and Bora, and you'll get all of the information there.
The Country Hour with Kate Forrester on ABC Radio WA.
Well, it's 21 past 12 on the Country Hour, and coming up before now and the news headlines at 12:30, we're actually going to be taking a look at some new technology to help the medicinal cannabis industry and to figure out crop potency. So stay tuned, because a little later on I will tell you all about what that is. But to begin with, Prime Minister Anthony Albanese says he makes no apology for a government-backed program which is looking at buying fishing boats for illegal fishers in Australia's north. But he wouldn't answer the questions on how much the program is costing taxpayers. Multiple sources have told us Australian Border Force has been buying fishing boats from across Australia for at least 2 years, using them to safely return intercepted people home and for agency training and surveillance. Now, we've been told by we've been told that the government has bought the commercial fishing boats for between $150,000 and $250,000. And here's a little bit of yesterday's media conference when the Prime Minister was asked for all the details on this program.
Prime Minister, why is your government buying fishing boats for illegal fishers or people smugglers found in our waters?
My government engaged in Operation Sovereign Borders because we said we would.
How much has that operation cost you over the last 2 years buying those fishing boats?
We engage in Operation Sovereign Borders. We make no apologies for that. We engage. I said we would. I said that people wouldn't be allowed to come here unauthorised. That's precisely what we're doing.
But are you subsidising people smugglers and illegal fishers into good quality boats?
No, what we're doing is making sure that we deliver.
Is it hard to convince Australians that you're doing all you can on housing migration when Border Force is handing perfectly good fishing vessels over to people smugglers?
No, well, the truth is that there were a range of operations were put in place, including under the former government, ones that it's up to them if they want to talk about that, they can. This isn't anything new to the government that I lead.
Would you see this operation backfiring, though, with all the Australian-made prey boats given to people smugglers? Should they come back for more and better boats?
No.
Well, no apologies there. Making sure that they're delivering. That's what you heard the Prime Minister Anthony Albanese speaking about at yesterday's media conference, where he was facing questions about the government scheme, which looks at buying fishing boats from Australians and then using them as a way of removing people from Australian waters. And on tomorrow's Country Hour, I'm going to be chatting to the Shadow Home Affairs Minister, Jono Dunium, on this topic, on the government's boat buying program. So make sure you tune in tomorrow's show at midday just to hear a little bit about what the opposition has to say in response. 24 past 12. A new non-destructive leaf scanning method has been developed by researchers in South Australia to accurately predict cannabis crop potency. Dr. Aaron Phillips is from the University of Adelaide, and he says the technology will start off being used on a smaller scale for medicinal cannabis, but into the future there could also be opportunities for growth and also for the industrial hemp industry.
In 2022, we started collaborating with an industry partner, and they were interested in developing a medicinal cannabis industry in South Australia. And one of the things that they wanted to know is whether it was possible to predict how potent the cannabis flowers would be prior to harvest. And we have an existing relationship with Compolytics, this German tech company. And so we thought, well, why don't we try and apply Compolytics technology to the question that our industry partner was asking. And yeah, that's how the project came about.
So this couldn't be done before this technique came about?
It could be done, but the way it's been done previously required you to destructively sample the plant. So you would have to like physically remove a flower and measure the reflectance of the flower itself. And of course, every time you damage the plant, you introduce the chance that it will be infected with some kind of disease, or you might change the way that it makes the cannabinoids from the damage that you've done to the plant. So this is the first time that a truly non-destructive method has been developed for this application.
And is this just for medicinal cannabis plants?
No, so it can be applied to any cannabis crop, so that includes industrial hemp. So one application that we see for this technology is farmers being able to, say you've got a field of industrial hemp, you might be able to fly a drone over that crop that has the hyperspectral technology on board. It can scan the crop and give you an indication of whether you've got any plants that are exceeding the legal THC limits that are imposed on industrial hemp growers.
And would that be different, the industrial hemp side be different to how you might use this technique with medicinal cannabis plants?
Yeah, so I guess the scale of the grows are different. So in an indoor setting, you've probably got a smaller footprint, so you're more likely going to use a handheld device, which is what this company, this German company Compolytics, develops. It's more feasible to check your plants with a handheld device. Whereas obviously on a farm situation, if you've got acres and acres of crop, you're going to want something like a drone that can capture more information for you faster.
And so, as you said there, using that handheld device, does it just sort of go over the top of the plants to detect what you need to be looking for?
So you can think about it like a barcode scanner that you might see at Coles or Woolies. It fits in your hand. It's got a little clip on the end of it, and you just put the leaf in the leaf clip section and you basically press go and it takes its readings. Those readings are fed into a mathematical model and the device can instantly tell you its prediction for all sorts of cannabinoids.
And is each leaf, is that a different, like a, you know, like a human's fingerprint?
Yeah, so the device works by measuring the wavelengths of light that the leaf reflects. And every leaf will have a different, it's called a spectral profile. Every leaf will have a different spectral profile. And we can use those differences in the spectral profiles to feed into the mathematical models to then determine all sorts of things about the plant.
Why is this technique so important for the cannabis industry?
Well, I guess there's kind of three parts to it. So we've already touched on how it might be important for industrial hemp growers in terms of detecting violations of the THC limits that they're held under. It's also important for medicinal cannabis growers because it can allow them to focus their resources on plants that are predicted to be elite performers. So if you're early in a grow cycle, if early on in the grow cycle you can identify plants that are probably not going to give you much bang for your buck, you can eliminate them from your grow, which means that you're saving time and money and resources on those low-performing plants. We also think that it can be used by breeders to help select for plants to help increase overall cannabinoid profiles.
You mentioned there about the industrial hemp growers and those strict THC limits that they've got. Does this save, you know, them having to destroy entire crops?
Yeah, so the idea would be that you identify plants that run hot so to speak, so plants that exceed the limit, and you can remove them before any kind of regulator comes along to check what's going on in your crop. So at the moment, if any violation of the threshold is detected, your entire crop can be destroyed.
University of Adelaide researcher Dr. Aaron Phillips speaking with Brooke Neindorf. 29 past 12. We are coming up to the headlines at 12:30. But before we get there, Anthony from Geraldton has texted in to say it costs about $140,000 to process an illegal fisherman in Australia, $300,000 per month to hold an illegal immigrant at Nauru, spending about $250,000 for a boat to carry 10 or 12 people at a time back to Indonesia and make a political point with Indonesia that if they don't tighten their borders and stop people smugglers using Indonesia as a gateway into here, then Australia will keep sending them back and make them Indonesia's problem. None of these cray boats sent to Indonesia have returned to Australian waters due to the high cost of operating them. The policy makes sense to me. Thank you, Anthony. And that's just in response to that earlier story we ran about the Prime Minister yesterday just addressing some questions about that boat buying program, which sees Australian vessels bought by the federal government and then given to either illegal fishermen or asylum seekers and then taken back to their country. So thank you for your thoughts on the text line. Do text through if you have something to say on 0448 922 604. But now, Jonathan Hopper, you have something to say.
Good afternoon, Kate. The state government says it's investigating how to secure Albany's future water needs a day after announcing a water recycling plant for Bunbury. Community reference groups are discussing groundwater and desalination as long-term sources for Albany's water supply. Water Minister Don Punch anticipates desalination will be the successful option, despite community concerns over the potential impact on the environment and local aquaculture industries. The ABC's managing director says there are real lessons to learn from a BBC report that's been criticised for how it edited a speech by US President Donald Trump. Senior managers have since resigned and the British news organisation has apologised to the president. And plans for a major aviation and marine base on a Kimberley Island have been approved by the WA Environment Minister. The hub on Cockatoo Island, 130 kilometres north of Derby in the Buccaneer Archipelago, will service the offshore oil and gas industry. Thanks, Kate.
Across Western Australia, this is The Country Hour with Kate Forrester on ABC Radio WA.
28 to 1 here on The Country Hour. Between now and the news at 1 o'clock, I'm going to take you to Katanning for today's numbers on the sheep sales. So stay tuned and listening to hear what those were. But now we're going to head to the Bureau where Caroline Crowe is joining me today. Caroline, let's start in the north of the state. What can you tell me what's happening up there?
Good afternoon, Kate. Okay, if we just start sort of short term, what's happening? We've got a broad trough over the northern parts of the state and just looking at some isolated showers and thunderstorms through the Kimberley into the north interior, eastern parts of the Pilbara, and then that extends into central parts of the state as well. So getting into eastern and southern parts of the Gascoyne, right through the goldfields, into the interior as well, and sort of lingering a little bit into sort of the far inland parts of the Eucla as well. That trough pretty much lingers around for the next few days as well. So similar area as we progress into Thursday. The thunderstorms pretty much through the eastern right down from the Kimberley all the way to the Eucla coming into Thursday, as well as continuing through the goldfields and southern parts of the Gascoyne. And then we'll see it sort of that trough continues to move a little bit further east. So through the Kimberley, eastern parts of the interior, continuing through southern and central parts of the goldfields and through the Eucla. And we'll continue then on Saturday and Sunday. That trough will continue to move east and we'll start seeing it more closer towards the far eastern parts of the state. The thunderstorms could be quite gusty, so could see the odd severe gust out of the thunderstorms, more likely through those central parts of the state. And as we progress into Friday as well, as the main part of the trough is in the southeastern parts of the state, could get some that wind and possibly some large hail through northern parts of the Eucla. So that's a watch point at this point in time. So we'd watch that as the days progress coming into Friday as well. The other watch point for the north at this point in time, a little bit further out still, though, is Tropical Cyclone Fina. So the tropical low that has been in offshore waters has been named overnight as a tropical cyclone. It's currently sitting north of the Northern Territory region. The motion of the system at this stage is moving east, although over the next couple of days is expected to turn more towards the south and then the southwest approach the northern top end. It is forecast then possibly to continue to move southwest later in the weekend, so more likely on Sunday or early next week, through the Timor Sea or closer to the Kimberley, northern parts of the Kimberley. So definitely a watch point as we progress into the weekend and early next week in regards to Tropical Cyclone Fina and the movements of Tropical Cyclone Fina. So just keep up to date with the forecasts and warnings on the Bureau's website and also on Emergency WA.
Caroline, are you saying Fina or Thina? Is it an F or a T?
It's an F.
Okay, F-I-N-A. So we're up to the letter F.
Yes, correct.
Right. Okay, good to know, because on yesterday's Country Hour, we didn't obviously have that name confirmed yet. So Tropical Cyclone Fina with an F.
Yes.
All right. Now let's move down into the south of the state. What's happening across the Southwest Land Division?
Yeah, well, through the Southwest Land Division, that trough that I spoke about through the central parts of the state extends towards the west coast with an embedded low. Now, that embedded low and the trough is gradually going to move over the west coast through today and over the next couple of days. But really, an arm of the trough continues to linger right back towards the west coast through a good part of this week. And bringing this system, or the weather, the trough and the embedded low is bringing showers and thunderstorms for most of the Southwest Land Division during today and coming into Thursday as well. There is the chance that these thunderstorms could be severe. That area of more likelihood of being severe is through western and northern parts of the Southwest Land Division. So for today, if we kind of the area is south of about Mullewa, Payne's Fines, out through the central wheat belt, towards Southern Cross region, around towards Narrogin as well, Harvey, and then bounded by the west coast. So that's the area there, if that, hopefully that made sense to everybody. Now, the main risk of severe thunderstorms for the area is rain. However, wind and hail is also possible. We do currently have a severe thunderstorm warning out for parts of the Southwest Land Division. So it was closer towards the west coast when we had plenty of thunderstorms starting pretty early this morning, just inland from the Perth Metro area and adjacent parts. Now, that area has been cancelled and we're just monitoring some thunderstorms through central parts of the central wheat belt as we stand at the moment. So that includes areas such as Meriden, Dowran, Cunderdon, Caliberan, Muckabuddin, through that area. And currently this severe thunderstorm warning is for heavy rainfall and potentially damaging wind gusts. So just keep an eye on the severe thunderstorm warnings during today as they will follow the thunderstorms and potentially extend through some parts based on what we see developing from a thunderstorm perspective. Coming into tomorrow, the heavy rain area first thing in the morning could be through far parts of the southeast of the Southwest Land Division, so southeastern parts of the central wheat belt and eastern parts of the Great Southern. However, as we progress into the afternoon and get some afternoon thunderstorms, it does move back a little bit more towards the Perth region, so the lower west and northeast of that area into the southern parts of the central wheat belt. Sorry, western parts of the central wheat belt and southern parts of the central west. And then coming into, so today and tomorrow are probably the days where we've got the most intense thunderstorms over the Southwest Land Division. Coming into Friday, the main trough has moved east and we've just got the branch coming back, which will keep lingering thunderstorms through parts of the Southwest Land Division through Friday and Saturday, and then gradually moving east on Sunday. I hope that made sense to everyone. It's quite a bit of a tricky, complex situation at the moment, but plenty of thunderstorms around potentially today and then towards the weekend and next week they will be easing.
Caroline, thanks for running me through that.
No worries, Kate.
And now Richard Hudson is in the studio just to run us through the rainfall figures.
Yes, up until 9 o'clock this morning in the north, nothing in the Kimberley or the Pilbara, but the Gascoyne had a few showers. So Bullardy ended up with 10 mils, Challa and Coodardie with 7, and Payne's Fine 6. And then there was nothing really in the interior or the goldfields or the Eucla districts. Nothing out on the islands, but in the southwest land division, a little bit hit and miss. In the central wheat belt, Barberton 5, Berkshire Valley 16, Bindi Bindi had between 7 and 9 mils. Karoo West had 29, I think that was the most. Dudawar 5, Erangie Springs 9, Gutha West and Latham 7 mils, Mindala 13, Morrowa 6, Perenjori, Three Springs and Wandana had 7 mils and Yandanooka 11. And then in the lower west, Bolgart Bin and 2J East recorded 7 and Watning 5. And then in the southwest, Dinanup 7. And then in the southern coastal region, many peaks topped it with 5. And in the central wheat belt, Amory Acres 17, Ballardew 7, Beacon 17, Burrakin 12, Cadoo, Cunderdon, Dalwallinu and Gemmalling all had 6 mils, Happy Valley 9. Killarney recorded 4 mils at the Deep Erd station, but I do know one Killarney farmer who got 25 mils. Cockerdyne had 7, Condit 6, Conongoring 11, Long Forest 10, Meckering North 11, Meriden 7, Monongarran had 19 mils over 2 days, Muckenbooden, Whale and Nattering all recorded 5, and then in the Great Southern, Franklin topped it with 7, no, Quail Up topped it with 13, Franklin had 7 and so did Riverdale. There's not only been a bit of rain around recently, but there's also been a few fires too. Just this morning, there was a fire just south of Fremantle. So it was in the Forestfield area. And when you look at the exact location, it was very, very, very close to CBH's main site there, which obviously holds grain and grain dust tends to be quite flammable. But I understand the fire was at Boortmalt's site. So Boortmalt is a Belgian-based company that mainly specialises in top-quality malt barley for brewers, distillers and food industries. So they deal in the sort of the beer and the whiskey market, I think. They have a kiln on site and it's my understanding that the fire there, I don't know if it started in the kiln, but anyway, burned about 40% of the wall cladding. Fire spread up to the roof and caused some damage, but DFIS says it's now contained. They got it under control. Firefighters are patrolling the area and mopping it up. I dare say the CBH managers were probably just a little bit nervous this morning because it was within throwing distance, I reckon.
I agree.
But this week, farmers in the area about 300 kilometres northeast of Perth are saying they've been fighting some of their most dangerous fires they can ever remember. Dylan Hirsch farms in the Perenjori Shire near Latham and says his crop looks like it's going to be his best ever, but he's been flat out harvesting, and then lightning fires on Monday and yesterday have burnt close to 1,000 hectares of crops.
Yeah, yesterday there was a couple of smaller fires in the region, but thankfully the rain sort of kept them at bay and they were put out pretty quickly. But on, was it Monday, we had a dry lightning strike on the neighbour's place, and yeah, that probably led to quite a dangerous one, really. I had a debrief with my dad even this morning, and he's nudging 70, and in his over 50 years of farm experience, he said he's never sort of seen a fire move quite as fast or as dangerously as that. Yeah, quite scary, and remind us that fire can move, faster than, perhaps even vehicles can move in some circumstances. So it'll certainly make us more cautious in the future.
In what way was it dangerous?
It was pretty run-of-the-mill at the start. It's, we're lightning strikes. We've got everyone on the fire alert WhatsApp in the region, and it works pretty well. Within minutes, we could see the lightning and then the fire come up, and, our units as well as neighbouring units were on their way to attend, and, it was burning some crop on a neighbour's place, very handy crop indeed. And then, unfortunately, a bit of wind came in, and sort of changed the nature of the fire, and it moved very quickly. And with a fuel load, it was quite scary, really. Probably a lot of most people who attended the fire would say it's probably one of, or if not the most dangerous fire that they've seen or attended.
Wow. It must have been quite frightening then.
Yeah, look, at the time, it sort of just become quite methodological. But, yeah, reflecting on it, you know, make sure, you're looking after your own self and out of the way. But, yeah, reflecting back on it, it's I'm very thankful no one was in the way, and, yeah, no one got stuck in a paddock because the fire moved that quickly. It was one where, yeah, someone could have got very hurt, unfortunately. Yeah, fortunately, no one did. Yeah, crop and minor infrastructure damage, really.
How much crop did it burn through?
I estimate three properties. It burnt through all standing wheat, probably about 900 hectares of crop, by my estimates, all up. And, yeah, maybe a couple of about 200 hectares of scrub and bushland as well. So, yeah, quite a big fire overall. It is a couple of k's wide and sort of up to about 9 k's long, I think, in total.
With so many lightning strikes at one time, now that you're reflecting back on it, you had them on Monday, but then more just yesterday. Have you learnt any lessons, do you think?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, it reinforces probably what we do already. I was really happy with how everyone responded overall. We had plenty, like the communication was very good. Initially, we had a lot of units attend, thankfully, and with such a widespread storms, it was tricky because there was other fires within the region further west of Carnarvon and north of Ferengary. So you've got to be wary that you can't suck all the units to the one fire, but we still had plenty of units there and we needed them all. There was certainly a bit of debrief about, you know, communication channels, the use of WhatsApp and UHF radios with so many units in attendance. It was a little bit tricky to coordinate, but I think everyone did really well. And I think with the local volunteer bushfire brigade, I reckon there'll be good room to debrief. And on our farm individually, we'll look at, you know, our communication equipment and make probably having an additional couple of handhelds, two ways, and more flexible equipment to be able to suck from different water sources, I think. So there's always debriefing on how we could do it better and make sure we're more prepared for the next one.
Do you think sometimes there's a tendency to swamp a fire and go too hard with units and you may be leaving yourself short for other areas that may also be under lightning strike threat?
I think most people are experienced enough to know when they're... And the beauty about internet communications now and on WhatsApp groups is we can very quickly know where a fire is, and people attending can communicate quite effectively how many additional units they might need. And that works actually really well, because if it's only a small fire, people, you know, it saves, false alarms and people from, you know, rushing from 60 kilometres away, because sometimes smoke can seem a lot closer than what it really is. So it does help with resource allocation. And I do think that's a big step up from where we've been, you know, probably 10 years ago before we had mobile phone coverage to be able to do that. But yet probably Monday's fire was there was certainly a bit of chaos in how fast it moved, so it was hard to coordinate units of where they need to be, because I'll be honest, I didn't even know how far it had moved. It probably moved several kilometres further than what I'd thought in the middle of the fire, so it was tricky to be able to get units where they needed to be. But overall, it worked really well.
But I gather you might have got some rain yesterday and overnight. How much did you have?
About 6 mil. Yesterday afternoon and overnight. So certainly thankful that the lightning that came through yesterday was followed up by a bit of rain as well, based on experience. But being farmers, we'll always whinge about something, and, you know, having to delay a day for a harvest will probably be, I'm not sure if we'll get harvesting again today on our canola, but we can never be fully happy, can we?
How's everything looking, though, apart from the crops that have been burnt? How's the canola and everything else looking?
Yeah, now, overall, really good, Richard. Yeah, the crops have been fantastic so far. It'll be certainly be a record for our region and personally on our farm as well. So yields have been really good. Quality's been really good. And, harvesting conditions generally really good. There's a lot of guys pretty keen to get back into harvest because anyone with holiday plans in January wants to try and get back into harvest as quick as possible. But I think, unfortunately, we'll be... still delivering a bit of rain into January like most people.
Good luck with it all, Dylan, and thanks for your time on the Country Hour.
Yeah, cheers, Richard.
And this season, Dylan Hirsch is growing wheat, canola and lupins just west and northwest of the Latham in the Perenjori Shire. And the small infrastructure damage he referred to was mainly some sheds and also some fences, but they aren't really needed anymore because the farmers in that area have got out of shape. But it was good to hear that no one was hurt.
This week on Landline, celebrating 80 years of the Country Hour.
Hello, everyone. This is Dick Snedden of the Country Hour with a program for the farm families of Australia.
That's Landline Sunday, 12:30 on ABC TV and iView.
And that will be a good episode, 80 years of the Country Hour. Well, Meat and Livestock Australia is involved in a project to see if goat salami could be something some farmers and station owners might make some money from. MLA's John Martin has played a key role in the collaborative project, and he says the idea to create salami using goat meat came from a couple of farmers over in New South Wales.
Well, it came from a passionate producer in New South Wales, Joe and Craig Stewart. So they've operated under the brand called the Gourmet Goat Lady, and we had done some smaller proof of concept works, mainly in the pet space with goats, ears of all things. But they had made a connection to a small goods manufacturer located in Sydney called Papandreou's Fine Foods. And they ran by Peter Binks from Papandreou's the idea of a goat salami. And after that initial conversation, Joe and Craig came back to us to discuss whether there was an investable project there.
So goat salami, have you tried it? What does it taste like?
Can I be honest with you? This is terrible. There's been so few samples around in the North Sydney offices that I've missed the sample it. But fortunately, we've got samples that have been manufactured specifically for the MLA Updates event in Adelaide this Thursday. We'll be kicking off later tomorrow night. So I can't wait to get my teeth stuck into it. And the reason why I haven't been able to get into any at the Sydney office is that it's been getting consumed before I've been able to get my hands on it.
Okay, so good feedback then by the sounds of it. So can you walk me through some of the details? Is it made from farmed goats or rangelands goats?
So at this stage, the protocols have been established by the New South Wales Food Authority for the safe food manufacturing of farm goat. So at this stage, we're working with farm goat coming off Joe and Craig's property, but the idea of expanding beyond farm goat into rangeland is potentially something that could be looked at into the future.
Salami is traditionally made from pork, isn't it? What's the fat ratio like when it comes to goat salami?
Yeah, good point. So initially there were some concerns raised, and before we started the project, they sort of said, look, goat traditionally is a pretty lean cut. And we normally like to have between a 60-40 up to 70-30 fat to meat ratio for the production of salami. And they felt that the goat meat might have been a bit too lean at 80-20, but it's actually worked out perfectly. Because we wanted to sort of develop a salami that satisfied consumers that were looking for something other than pork. And we were a little bit worried about that we'd have to substitute goat fat with potentially some other fats, including pork. But the processors were really excited when they first sampled their first production run and said, actually, we're pretty happy with the ratio of fat to lean meat.
And so you said it's made from farmed goats. I'm talking to you today from over in Western Australia in an area where there are quite a lot of rangelands goats running around in the Gascoyne. What would need to happen to be able to make goat salami from rangelands goats?
Yeah, look, interesting one. We'd obviously work with the state regulator there, the State Food Authority, and understand what protocols would need to be established to be able to test the ability for us to manufacture a goat salami from rangeland goat. And obviously, ideally, we'd need to find a processor over that side of town that would be willing to work with us and partner with us on that journey. So, you know, if there are interested producers that have a potential connection with a small goods processor or know someone in that space in the Western Australian community, then we'd be happy to hear about who the players might be and have initial discussions.
And how, it might be a bit early for this one, but how would the price compare to some of the more traditional types of salami as a buyer, like a consumer in the supermarket?
Yeah, again, that's a really tough one because obviously pricing ultimately will be dictated by the volumes that the processor can manufacture in one hit. So it really is going to be dependent upon the consumer's appetite for goat salami, I guess. The more of it, the better from a price perspective. But look, that will remain to be seen. And pending the success in the domestic market, certainly we've got massive interest for Australian goat in a lot of export markets. So we know that North America, we've got Mexico, we've got the Caribbean, and we've got Canada, who are significant consumers of Australian goat meat. And we've also got the Middle East and Africa as well. So we're really keen to get some initial feedback from the domestic market and then understand what the next steps for our goat salami might be in much bigger international export markets.
And just out of interest, how long did it take from when this was just an idea to now? What was that process like?
This was actually really, and it might sound like a long time, but this was about a 9-month project, which for all intents and purposes was pretty quick considering we really didn't have any history to go on. So we were really starting from scratch with a blank canvas. And I guess that in turn leads to the question, you know, might other projects in a similar vein take less time? The answer is I don't know. But look, at least now we do have a bit of a roadmap for how we went about this. And we've got, you know, an existing bit of research, albeit conducted in New South Wales. But again, we're happy to look at what needs to be done to expand the potential for other goat.
John Martin from Meat and Livestock Australia. He was chatting to Georgia Hargreaves about goat salami. And I'm interested to try that one day.
Hello, I'm Andy Park. Join me for The World Today as the US Senate passes a bill to release the files around convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Donald Trump says he'll sign it. Victoria to establish a new youth crime unit, an emulation of the Scottish Violence Reduction Unit, which tackled youth crime in Glasgow 20 years ago. And bookworms, we're back. Why libraries across Australia are enjoying a 10% surge in visits and borrowing. Those stories and more. Join me for The World Today.
That coming up after the news headlines at 1 o'clock. But another headline from today's sheep sale at Katanning is actually quite similar to yesterday's at Mushay. Lower numbers and higher prices was today's headline. The drop in numbers was probably due to harvesting, though. Now, the final tally was 10,200, so that's down about 3,000 on last week. Tracy Kilner, can you please run me through the details?
The bulk of the lamb yarding were light, weight or unfinished, but demand pushed all weight categories up on last week. Hoggets sold to increased values, while demand from processors saw store mutton gain $20 a kilo. The new season lambs weighing under 16 kilos carcass weight sold from 130 to 186. Heavier lambs made from 160 to $200 a head. Trade weight lambs sold from 186 to $260 and heavy weights from 230 to $296 a head. Merino store weather hoggets ranged from 82 to 150 and the medium and heavyweight sold from 156 up to $252. Merino ewe hoggets returned from 129 to 154 for lightweights, medium and heavyweights made from 172 to $263. Store mutton sold from 81 up to $202 for the large frame ewes carrying a fleece. The prime medium weight ewes returned from 170 to 229, and heavyweight ewes over 30 kilos carcass weight sold from 205 up to $241 a head. Mature store weathers made from 140 to 181, while the medium weights returned 180 up to 225. Good numbers of mature rams sold from 60 to 220 with increased demand from processors. This has been Tracy Kilner for Meat and Livestock Australia's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thank you, Tracy. And the exact figures today were 10,205, and that was down 2,903 on last week. We're coming up to the news at 1 o'clock, but if you would like to read a little bit more on that story about the federal government buying up commercial fishing boats, you can do so. You can just hop online and search ABC News and WA Boats, and you'll find Joe Prendergast's story at the top of the homepage. It's just gone up now, so definitely jump on to search ABC News and WA Boats and you'll be able to find all that information there. Thank you so much for tuning in today on the Country Hour right across Western Australia, wherever you might be listening from. And also tomorrow, as I said, we will have that opposition Foreign Affairs Minister on just about the boat program as well. So do be sure to tune in from 12 o'clock tomorrow. Anyway, have a good afternoon. It's 1 o'clock news time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.